This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Wave by Todd Strasser. Narrated by Michael Crouch. Foreword. The Wave is based on a true incident that occurred in a high school history class in Palo Alto, California, in 1969. For 3 years afterward, according to the teacher, Ron Jones, no one talked about it. It was, he said, one of the most frightening events I have ever experienced in the classroom. The Wave disrupted an entire school. The novel dramatizes the incident, showing how the powerful forces of group pressure that have pervaded many historic movements and cults can persuade people to join such movements and give up their individual rights in the process, sometimes causing great harm to others. The full impact on the students of what they lived through and learned is realistically portrayed in the book that follows. In addition to the novel, The Wave has been made into a 1-hour television show for ABC by Virginia L. Carter, an executive director at Tandem Productions and TAT Communications Company. Harriet Harvey Coffin, Project Consultant, TAT Communications Company. Chapter 1. Lori Saunders sat in the publications office at Gordon High School, chewing on the end of a Bic pen. She was a pretty girl, with short, light brown hair, and an almost perpetual smile that only disappeared when she was upset or chewing on Bic pens. Lately, she'd been chewing on a lot of pens. In fact, there wasn't a single pen or pencil in her pocketbook that wasn't worn down on the butt end from nervous gnawing. Still, it beat smoking. Lori looked around the small office, a room filled with desks, typewriters, and light tables. At that moment, there should have been kids at each one of those typewriters, punching out stories for the Gordon Grapevine, the school paper. The art and layout staff should have been working at the light tables, laying out the next issue. But instead, the room was empty except for Lori. The problem was that it was a beautiful day outside. Lori felt the plastic tube of the pen crack. Her mother had warned her once that someday she would chew on a pen until it splintered, and a long plastic shard would lodge in her throat and she would choke to death on it. Only her mother could have come up with that, Lori thought with a sigh. She looked up at the clock on the wall. Only a few minutes were left in the period anyway. There was no rule that said anyone had to work in the publications office during their free periods, but they all knew that the next edition of The Grapevine was due out next week. Couldn't they give up their frisbees and cigarettes and suntans for just a few days in order to get an issue of the paper out on time? Lori put her pen back in her pocketbook and started to gather up her notebooks for the next period. It was hopeless. For the 3 years she'd been on staff, The Grapevine had always been late. And now that she was the editor-in-chief, it made no difference. The paper would be done when everyone got around to doing it. Pulling the door of the publications office closed behind her, Lori stepped out into the hall. It was practically empty now. The bell to change classes had not yet rung, and there were only a few students around. Lori walked down a few doors, stopped outside a classroom, and peered through the window. Inside, her best friend, Amy Smith, a petite girl with thick, curly Goldilocks hair, was trying to endure the final moments of Mr. Gabondi's French class. Lori had taken French with Mr. Gabondi the year before, and it had been one of the most excruciatingly boring experiences of her life. Mr. Gabondi was a short, dark, heavy-set man who always seemed to be sweating, even on the coldest winter days. When he taught, he spoke in a dull monotone that could easily put the brightest student to sleep. And even though the course he taught was not difficult, Lori recalled how hard it had been to pay enough attention to get an A. Now watching her friend struggle to stay interested, Lori decided she needed some cheering up. So, positioning herself outside the door where Amy could see her, but Gabandi could not. Lori crossed her eyes and made an idiotic face. Amy reacted by putting her hand over her mouth to keep from laughing. Lori made another face, and Amy tried not to look, but she couldn't help turning back to see what her friend was doing next. Then Lori did her famous fish face. She pushed her ears out, crossed her eyes, and puckered her lips. Amy was trying so hard not to laugh that tears started to roll down her cheeks. Lori knew she shouldn't make any more faces. Watching Amy was too funny. Anything could make her laugh. If Lori did any more, Amy would probably fall out of her seat and roll into the aisle between the desks. But Lori couldn't resist. Turning her back to the door to create some suspense, she screwed up her mouth and eyes, and then spun around. Standing at the door was a very angry Mr. Gabandi. Behind him, Amy and the rest of her class were in hysterics. Lori's jaw dropped. But before Gabandi could reprimand her, the bell rang and his class was suddenly spilling out into the hall around him. Amy came out holding her sides in pain from laughing so hard. As Mr. Gabandi glared at them, the two girls went off arm in arm toward their next class, too out of breath to laugh anymore. In the classroom where he taught history, Ben Ross crouched over a film projector, trying to thread a film through the complex maze of rollers and lenses. This was his fourth attempt, and he still hadn't gotten it right. Frustrated, Ben ran his fingers through his wavy brown hair. All his life he had been befuddled by machinery. Film projectors, cars, even the self-service pump at the local gas station drove him bananas. He had never been able to figure out why he was so inept in that way. And so when it came to anything mechanical, he left it to Christy, his wife. She taught music and choir at Gordon High. And at home, she was in charge of anything that required manual dexterity. She often joked that Ben couldn't even be trusted to change a light bulb correctly, although Ben insisted this was an exaggeration. He had changed a number of light bulbs in his life and could only recall breaking two in the process. Thus far in his career at Gordon High, Ben and Christy had been teaching there for 2 years. He had managed to hide his mechanical inabilities. Or rather, they had been overshadowed by his growing reputation as an outstanding young teacher. Ben's students spoke of his intensity, the way he got so interested and involved in a topic that they couldn't help but be interested also. He was contagious, they'd say, meaning he was charismatic. He could get through to them. Ross's fellow faculty members were somewhat more divided in their feelings toward him. Some of them were impressed with his energy and dedication and creativity. It was said that he brought a new outlook to his classes. That whenever possible, he tried to teach his students the practical, relevant aspects of history. If they were studying the political system, he would divide the class into political parties. If they studied a famous trial, he might assign one student to be the defendant, others to be the prosecution and defense attorneys, and still others to sit as the jury. But other faculty members were more skeptical about Ben. Some said he was just young, naive, and overzealous, that after a few years he would calm down and start conducting classes the right way. Lots of reading, weekly quizzes, classroom lectures. Others simply said they didn't like the way he never wore a suit and tie in class. One or two might even admit they were just plain jealous. But if there was one thing no teacher had to be jealous of, it was Ben's total inability to cope with film projectors. While perhaps brilliant otherwise, now he only scratched his head and looked at the tangle of celluloid bunched in the machine. In just a few minutes, his senior history class would arrive, and he had been looking forward to showing them this film for weeks. Why hadn't his teacher's college given a course in film threading? Ross rolled the film back into its spool and left it unthreaded. No doubt one of the kids in his class was some kind of audio-visual whiz and could get the machine going in an instant. He walked back to his desk and picked up a pile of homework papers he wanted to distribute to the students before they saw the film. The marks on the papers had gotten predictable, Ben thought as he thumbed through them. As usual, there were two A papers, Laurie Saunders's and Amy Smith's. There was one A-minus, then the normal bunch of B's and C's. There were two D's. One was Brian Ammon, a quarterback on the football team, who seemed to enjoy getting low marks, even though it was obvious to Ben that he had the brains to do much better if he tried. The other D was Robert Billings, the class loser. Ross shook his head. The Billings boy was a real problem. Outside in the hall, the bells rang, and Ben heard the sounds of class doors banging open and students flooding into the corridors. It was peculiar how students always left class so quickly, but somehow arrived at their next class at the speed of snails. Generally, Ben believed that high school today was a better place for kids to learn than it was when he went. But there were a few things that bothered him. One was his students' lackadaisical attitude about getting to class on time. Sometimes 5 or even 10 minutes of valuable class time would be lost while students straggled in. Back when he was a student, if you weren't in class when the second bell rang, you were in trouble. The other problem was the homework. Kids just didn't feel compelled to do it anymore. You could yell, threaten them with Fs or detention, and it didn't matter. Homework had become practically optional. Or, as one of his ninth graders had told him a few weeks before, "Sure, I know homework is important, Mr. Ross, but my social life comes first." Ben chuckled. Social life. Students were starting to enter the classroom now. Ross spotted David Collins, a tall, good-looking boy who was a running back on the football team. He was also Laurie Saunders' boyfriend. "David," Ross said, "do you think you could get that film projector set up?"
"Sure thing," David replied.
As Ross watched, David kneeled beside the projector and went to work nimbly. In just a few seconds, he had it threaded. Ben smiled and thanked him. Robert Billings trudged into the room. He was a heavy boy, with shirt tails perpetually hanging out and his hair always a mess, as if he never bothered to comb it after getting out of bed in the morning.
"We gonna see a movie?"
he asked when he saw the projector.
"No, dummy,"
said a boy named Brad, who especially enjoyed tormenting him.
"Mr. Ross just likes to set up projectors for fun."
"Okay, Brad," Ben said sternly. "That's enough." A sufficient number of students had arrived for Ross to start handing out the homework papers.
"All right," he said loudly to get the class's attention. "Here are last week's papers. Generally speaking, you did a good job."
He walked up and down the aisles, passing each paper to its author. "But I'm warning you again. These papers are getting much too sloppy." He stopped and held one up for the class to see.
"Look at this. Is it really necessary to doodle in the margins of a homework paper?"
The class tittered.
"Whose is it?" someone asked. "None of your business."
Ben shuffled the papers in his hand and kept handing them out.
"From now on, I'm going to start lowering grades on any papers that are really sloppy. If you've made a lot of changes or mistakes on a paper, make a new, neat copy before you hand it in. Got that?"
Some members of the class nodded. Others weren't even paying attention. Ben went to the front of the classroom and pulled down the movie screen. It was the third time that semester he'd talked to them about messy homework. Chapter 2. They were studying World War II, and the film Ben Ross was showing his class that day was a documentary depicting the atrocities the Nazis committed in their concentration camps. In the darkened classroom, the class stared at the movie screen. They saw emaciated men and women starved so severely that they appeared to be nothing more than skeletons covered with skin. People whose knee joints were the widest part of their legs. Ben had already seen this film, or films like it, half a dozen times. But the sight of such ruthless, inhumane cruelty by the Nazis still horrified him and made him feel angry. As the film rolled on, he spoke emotionally to the class. "What you are watching took place in Germany between 1934 and 1945. It was the work of a man named Adolf Hitler, originally a menial laborer, porter, and house painter, who turned to politics after World War I. Germany had been defeated in that war. Its leadership was at a low ebb, inflation was high, and thousands were homeless, hungry, and jobless. For Hitler, it was an opportunity to rise quickly through the political ranks of the Nazi Party. He espoused the theory that the Jews were the destroyers of civilization and that the Germans were a superior race. Today we know that Hitler was a paranoid, a psychopath, literally a madman. In 1923, he was thrown in jail for his political activities. But by 1934, he and his party had seized control of the German government." Ben paused for a moment to let the students watch more of the film. They could see the gas chambers now, and the piles of bodies laid out like stove wood. The human skeletons still alive had the gruesome task of stacking the dead under the watching eyes of the Nazi soldiers. Ben felt his stomach churn. How on God's earth could anyone make anyone else do something like that? He asked himself. He told the students, "The death camps were what Hitler called his final solution to the Jewish problem. But anyone, not just Jews, deemed by the Nazis as unfit for their superior race was sent there. They were herded into camps all over Eastern Europe. And once there, they were worked, starved, and tortured. And when they couldn't work anymore, they were exterminated in the gas chambers. Their remains were disposed of in ovens." Ben paused for a moment and then added, "The life expectancy of the prisoners in the camps was 270 days, but many did not survive a week." On the screen, they could see the buildings that housed the ovens. Ben thought of telling the students that the smoke rising from the chimneys above the buildings was from burning human flesh. But he didn't. The experience of watching this film would be awful enough. Thank God man had not invented a way to convey smells through film, because the worst thing of all would have been the stench of it. The stench of the most heinous act ever committed in the history of the human race. The film was ending, and Ben told his students, "In all, the Nazis murdered more than 10 million men, women, and children in their extermination camps." The film was over. A student near the door flicked the classroom lights on. As Ben looked around the room, most of the students looked stunned. Ben had not meant to shock them, but he'd known that the film would. Most of these students had grown up in the small, suburban community that spread out lazily around Gordon High. They were the products of stable, middle-class families, and despite the violent, saturated media that permeated society around them, they were surprisingly naive and sheltered. Even now, a few of the students were starting to fool around. The misery and horror depicted in the film must have seemed to them like just another television program. Robert Billings, sitting near the windows, was asleep with his head buried in his arms on his desk. But near the front of the room, Amy Smith appeared to be wiping a tear out of her eye. Lori Saunders looked upset, too. "I know many of you are upset," Ben told the class. "But I did not show you this film today just to get an emotional reaction from you. I want you to think about what you saw and what I told you. Does anyone have any questions?" Amy Smith quickly raised her hand. "Yes, Amy?" "Were all the Germans Nazis?" she asked. Ben shook his head. "No, as a matter of fact. Less than 10% of the German population belonged to the Nazi Party." "Then why didn't anyone try to stop them?" Amy asked. "I can't tell you for sure, Amy," Ross told her. "I can only guess that they were scared. The Nazis might have been a minority, but they were a highly organized, armed, and dangerous minority.
You have to remember that the rest of the German population was unorganized and unarmed and frightened. They had also gone through a terrible period of inflation that had virtually ruined their country. Perhaps some of them hoped the Nazis would be able to restore their society. Anyway, after the war, the majority of Germans said they didn't know about the atrocities. Near the front of the room, a black youth named Eric raised his hand urgently. "That's crazy," he said. "How could you slaughter 10 million people without somebody noticing?" "Yeah," said Brad, the boy who had picked on Robert Billings before class began. "That can't be true." It was obvious to Ben that the film had affected a large part of the class, and he was pleased. It was good to see them concerned about something. "Well," he said to Eric and Brad, "I can only tell you that after the war, the Germans claimed they knew nothing of the concentration camps or the killings." Now Laurie Saunders raised her hand. "But Eric's right," she said. "How could the Germans sit back while the Nazis slaughtered people all around them and say they didn't know about it? How could they do that? How could they even say that?" "All I can tell you," Ben said, "is that the Nazis were highly organized and feared. The behavior of the rest of the German population is a mystery. Why they didn't try to stop it, how they could say they didn't know, we just don't know the answers." Eric's hand was up again. "All I can say is, I would never let such a small minority of people rule the majority." "Yeah," said Brad. "I wouldn't let a couple of Nazis scare me into pretending I didn't see or hear anything." There were other hands raised with questions. But before Ben could call on anyone, the bell rang out and the class was rushing out into the hall. David Collins stood up. His stomach was grumbling like mad. That morning he'd gotten up late and had to skip his usual 3-course breakfast to make it to school on time. Even though the film Mr. Ross had shown really bothered him, he couldn't help thinking that next period was lunch. He looked over at Laurie Saunders, his girlfriend, who was still sitting in her seat. "Come on, Laurie," he urged her. "We have to get down to the cafeteria fast. You know how long the line gets." But Laurie waved him to go without her. "I'll catch up later." David scowled. He was torn between waiting for his girlfriend and filling his growling stomach. The stomach won, and David took off down the hall. After he was gone, Laurie got up from her seat and looked at Mr. Ross. There were only a couple of kids left in the room now, and except for Robert Billings, who was just waking up from his nap, they were the ones who seemed the most disturbed about the film. "I can't even believe that all the Nazis were that cruel," Laurie told her teacher. "I don't believe anyone could be that cruel." Ben nodded. After the war, many Nazis tried to excuse their behavior by claiming they were only following orders and that they would have been killed themselves if they hadn't. Laurie shook her head. "No, that's no excuse. They could have run away. They could have fought back. They had their own eyes and their own minds. They could think for themselves. Nobody would just follow an order like that." "But that's what they said," Ben told her. Laurie shook her head again. "It's sick," she said, her voice filled with revulsion. "Just totally sick." Ben could only nod in agreement. Robert Billings was trying to sneak past Ben's desk. "Robert," Ben said, "wait a minute." The boy froze, but could not look his teacher in the eye. "Are you getting enough sleep at home?" Ben asked. Robert nodded dumbly. Ben sighed. All semester he had been trying to get through to this boy. He couldn't stand seeing him picked on by the other students, and it dismayed him that Robert didn't at least try to participate in class. "Robert," his teacher said sternly, "if you don't start participating in this class, I will have to fail you. You'll never graduate at this rate." Robert glanced at his teacher and then looked away again. "Don't you have anything to say?" Ben asked. Robert shrugged. "I don't care,"
he said.
What do you mean you don't care? Ben asked.
Robert took a few steps toward the door. Ben could see that he was uncomfortable about being questioned.
Robert?
The boy stopped. But he still could not look at his teacher.
I wouldn't do any good anyway, he mumbled.
Ben wondered what he could say. Robert's case was a tough one. The younger brother wallowing in the shadow of an older brother who had been the quintessential model student and big man on campus. Jeff Billings had been an all-conference pitcher in high school and was now in the Baltimore Orioles farm system while he studied medicine in the off-season. In school, he'd been a straight-A student who excelled at everything he did. The kind of guy even Ben had despised in high school. Seeing that he could never compete with his brother's achievements, Robert had apparently decided it was better not even to try.
Listen, Robert, Ben said. No one expects you to be another Jeff Billings.
Robert glanced quickly at Ben and then started chewing nervously on his thumbnail.
All we're asking is that you try, Ben said.
I have to go, Robert said, looking down at the floor.
I don't even care about sports, Robert, Ben said.
But the boy had already begun to move slowly toward the door. Chapter 3 David Collins was sitting in the outdoor courtyard next to the cafeteria. He had already wolfed down his lunch by the time Lori arrived, and he was beginning to feel like a normal human being again. He watched Lori put her tray down next to his and then noticed that Robert Billings was also headed for the courtyard.
Hey, look,
David whispered as Lori sat down. They watched as Robert stepped out of the cafeteria carrying a tray, looking for a place to eat. True to form, he had already started eating and stood in the doorway with half a hot dog sticking out of his mouth. There were two girls from Mr. Ross's history class sitting at the table Robert chose. As Robert set his tray down, they both stood up and took their trays to another table. Robert pretended he hadn't noticed. David shook his head.
Gordon High's very own untouchable, he mumbled.
Do you think there's something really wrong with him? Lori asked. David shrugged.
I don't know. He's been pretty strange for as long as I can remember. Then again, if people treated me like that, I'd probably be pretty strange too. It's just weird that he and his brother could come from the same family.
Did I ever tell you that my mother knows his mother? Lori asked.
His mother ever talk about him? David asked.
No. Except I think she told me once that they had him tested, and he really does have a normal IQ. He's not really dumb or anything.
Just weird, David said and went back to eating his lunch.
But Lori only picked at hers. She seemed preoccupied.
What is it? David asked.
That film, David, Lori answered. It really bothers me. Doesn't it bother you?
David thought for a moment. Then he said, Yeah, sure. As something horrible that happened once, it bothers me. But that was a long time ago, Lori. To me, it's like a piece of history. You can't change what happened then.
But you can't forget it, Lori said.
She tried a bite of her hamburger, then made a face and put it down. Well, you can't go around being bummed out about it for the rest of your life, either, David said.
He eyed Lori's uneaten hamburger.
By the way, you gonna eat that?
Lori shook her head. The movie had left her without much of an appetite. Help yourself.
Not only did David help himself to her burger, he finished off her fries, salad, and ice cream as well.
Lori looked in his direction, but her eyes were distant. David wiped his lips with a napkin.
Would you like anything more? Lori asked. Well, to tell you the truth...
Hey, is this seat taken?
someone behind them said.
I was here first, said another voice.
David and Lori looked up to find Amy Smith and Brian Ammon, the quarterback, both heading for their table from opposite directions.
What do you mean you were here first? Brian asked.
Well, I meant I wanted to be here first, Amy replied.
Meaning to be first doesn't count, Brian said. Besides, I have to talk to Dave about football.
And I have to talk to Lori, Amy said.
What about? Brian asked.
Well, about keeping her company while you talk about boring football.
Stop it, Lori said. There's room for two.
But with them, you need room for three, Amy said,
nodding at Brian and David.
Hardy har har, Brian grunted.
David and Lori slid over, and Amy and Brian squeezed in next to them at the table. Amy was right about room for three. Brian was carrying two full lunch trays.
Hey, what are you doing with all this food? David asked, patting Brian on the back.
Although he was the team's quarterback, Brian was not very big. David stood a full head taller than him.
I gotta gain some weight, Brian said as he started to wolf down his lunch. I'm gonna need every pound I've got against these guys from Clarkstown on Saturday. They are big. I mean, huge. I hear they got a linebacker who stands 6'3 and weighs 220.
I don't see what you're worried about, Amy said. No one that heavy can run very fast.
Brian rolled his eyes.
He doesn't have to run, Amy. All he has to do is squash quarterbacks.
Will you have a chance on Saturday? Lori asked. She was thinking about the story they would need for the grapevine. David shrugged.
I don't know. The team's pretty disorganized. We're way behind on learning our plays and stuff. Half the guys don't even show up for practice.
Yeah, Brian agreed.
Coach Schiller said he was going to throw anyone who didn't show up for practice off the team. But if he did that, we wouldn't even have enough guys to play.
No one seemed to have anything more to say about football, so Brian bit into his second hamburger. David's thoughts drifted to other pressing matters.
Hey, is anyone here good at calculus?
Why are you taking calculus? Amy asked.
You need it for engineering, David said.
So why not wait till college? Brian asked.
I heard it was so hard you have to take it twice to understand it, David explained. So I figured I'd take it once now and once later.
Amy nudged Lori.
I think your boyfriend is strange, she said.
Talk about strange, Brian whispered, nodding toward Robert Billings.
They all looked. Robert was sitting alone at his table, engrossed in a Spider-Man comic book. His lips moved as he read, and there was a red streak of ketchup on his chin.
You see him sleep through the whole movie? Brian asked.
Don't remind Lori, David told him. She's upset.
What, about that movie? Brian asked.
Lori gave David a dirty look.
Do you have to tell everybody?
Well, it's true, isn't it? David asked.
Oh, just leave me alone, Lori answered.
I can understand how you feel, Amy told her.
I thought it was just awful.
Lori turned to David.
There, you see? I'm not the only one that it bothered.
Hey, David said defensively. I didn't say I wasn't bothered by it. I just said it's over now. Forget about it. It happened once, and the world learned its lesson. It'll never happen again.
I hope not, Lori said, picking up her tray.
Where are you going? David asked her.
I have to go work on the grapevine, Lori said. Wait, Amy said. I'll go with you.
David and Brian watched the two girls go.
Gee, she really is upset about that movie, isn't she? Brian said.
Yeah. David nodded. You know, she always takes stuff like that too seriously.
Amy Smith and Lori Saunders sat in the grapevine office talking. Amy wasn't on the newspaper staff, but she often hung out with Lori in the publications office. The office door could be locked, and Amy would sit inside by an open window, holding a cigarette outside and blowing the smoke out. If a teacher came in, she could drop the cigarette on the ground, and there would hardly be any smell of smoke in the room. "That was an awful movie," Amy said. Lori nodded quietly. "Are you and David having a fight?" her friend asked. "Oh, not really." Lori couldn't help smiling slightly. "I just wish he would take something besides football seriously. He's such a jock sometimes. But he gets good grades," Amy said. "At least he's not a dumb jock like Brian." The two girls giggled for a moment, and then Amy asked, "Why does he want to be an engineer? It sounds so boring." "He wants to be a computer engineer," Lori said. "Did you ever see the one he has at home? He built it from a kit." "Somehow I missed it," Amy said facetiously. "By the way, have you decided what you're doing next year?" Lori shook her head. "Maybe we'll go somewhere together. It depends on where we get accepted." "Your parents will be thrilled," Amy said. "I don't think they'd mind that much," Lori said. "Why don't you just get married?" Amy asked. Lori made a face. "Oh, Amy. I mean, I guess I love David, but who wants to get married yet?" Amy smiled. "Oh, I don't know. If David asked me, I might consider it," she teased. Lori laughed. "Would you like me to drop a hint?" "Come off it, Lori," Amy said. "You know how much he likes you. He doesn't even look at other girls." "He'd better not," Lori said. She noticed that there was a wistful note to Amy's voice. Ever since Lori had started dating David, Amy had wanted to date a football player, too. It sometimes bothered Lori that underlying their friendship was a constant competition for boys, grades, popularity, almost everything one could compete for. Even though they were best friends, that constant competition somehow prevented them from being really close. Suddenly, there was a loud knock on the door, and someone tried the doorknob. Both girls jumped. "Who is it?" Lori asked.
"Principal Owens," a deep voice replied. "Why is this door locked?"
Amy's eyes went wide with fear. She quickly dropped her cigarette and started digging through her pocketbook for a stick of gum or a mint.
It must have been an accident," Lori replied nervously, going to the door.
"Well, open it immediately."
Amy looked terrified. Lori gave her a helpless look and pulled the door open. Outside in the hall were Carl Block, the Grapevine's investigative reporter, and Alex Cooper, the music reviewer. They were both grinning.
"Oh, you two," Lori said angrily.
Behind her, Amy looked like she was going to faint as the two biggest practical jokers in the school stepped into the room. Carl was a tall, thin guy with blonde hair. Alex, who was stocky and dark, was wearing earphones connected to a small tape player.
"Something illegal going on in here?" Carl asked slyly, making his eyebrows bounce up and down.
"You made me waste a perfectly good cigarette," Amy complained.
"Tisk tisk," Alex said, looking on disapprovingly.
"So how is the paper coming?" Carl asked.
"What do you mean?" Lori asked in exasperation.
"Neither of you has handed in your assignments for this issue."
"Oh, oh!"
Alex was suddenly looking at his watch and backing away toward the door.
"I just remembered I have to catch a plane to Argentina."
"I'll drive you to the airport," Carl said, following him out the door.
Lori looked at Amy and shook her head wearily. "Those two," she mumbled, making a fist. Chapter 4 Something bothered Ben Ross. He couldn't quite put his finger on it, but he was intrigued by the questions the kids in his history class had asked him after the film that day. It made him wonder.
Why hadn't he been able to give the students adequate answers to their questions? Was the behavior of the majority of Germans during the Nazi regime really so inexplicable? That afternoon before he left school, Ross had stopped at the library and taken out an armful of books. His wife, Christy, would be playing tennis that evening with some friends, so he knew he would have a long period of uninterrupted time to pursue his thoughts. Now, several hours later, after reading through a number of books, Ben suspected that he would not find the real answer written anywhere. It made him wonder. Was this something historians knew words could not explain? Was it something one could only understand by being there? Or, if possible, by recreating a similar situation? The idea intrigued Ross. Suppose, he thought, just suppose he took a period, perhaps two periods, and tried an experiment. Just tried to give his students a sampling, a taste of what life in Nazi Germany might have been like. If he could just figure out how it could be done, how the experiment could be run, he was certain it would make far more of an impression on the students than any book explanation could ever make. It certainly was worth a try. Christy Ross didn't get in that night until after 11 o'clock. She'd played tennis and then had dinner with a friend. She got home to find her husband sitting at their kitchen table surrounded by books. "Doing your homework?" "In a way, yes," Ben Ross replied without looking up from his books. On top of one of the books, Christy noticed an empty glass and an empty plate with a few crumbs from what once must have been a sandwich. "Well, at least you remembered to feed yourself," she said, picking up the dish and placing it in the sink. Her husband didn't answer. His nose was still stuck in the book. "I bet you're just dying to find out how badly I beat Betty Lewis tonight," she said, kidding him. Ben looked up. "What?" "I said I beat Betty Lewis tonight," Christy told him. Her husband had a blank look on his face. Christy laughed. "Betty Lewis. You know, the Betty Lewis who I've never won more than two games in a set from? I beat her tonight. In two sets. 6-4, 7-5. "Oh, that's very good," Ben said absently. He looked back down at the book and started reading again. Someone else might have been offended by his apparent rudeness, but Christy wasn't. She knew Ben was the kind of person who got involved with things. Not just involved, but utterly absorbed in them to the point where he tended to forget that the rest of the world existed. She'd never forget the time in graduate school when he got interested in American Indians. For months, he was so wrapped up in Indians that he forgot about the rest of his life. On weekends, he'd visit Indian reservations or spend hours looking for old books in dusty libraries. He even started bringing Indians home for dinner and wearing deerskin moccasins. Christy used to get up some mornings wondering if he was going to put on war paint. But that was the way Ben was. One summer, she taught him to play bridge, and within a month, not only was he a better bridge player than she, but he was driving her crazy, insisting that they play bridge every minute of the day. He only calmed down after he won a local bridge tournament and ran out of worthy competitors. It was almost frightening, the way he lost himself in each new adventure. Christy looked at the books scattered about the kitchen table and sighed. "What is it this time?" she asked. "The Indians again? Astronomy? The behavioral characteristics of killer whales?" When her husband didn't answer, she picked up some of the books. "The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich? Hitler's Youth?" She frowned. "What are you doing? Cramming for a degree in dictatorship?" "Not funny," Ben muttered without looking up. "You're right," Christy admitted. Ben Ross sat back and looked at his wife. "One of my students asked me a question today that I couldn't answer." "So what else is new?" Christy asked. "But I don't think I ever saw the answer written anywhere," Ben told her.
It just may be an answer they have to learn for themselves.
Christy Ross nodded.
Well, I can see what kind of night this is going to be, she said. Just remember, tomorrow you have to be awake enough to teach an entire day of classes.
Her husband nodded.
I know, I know.
Christy Ross bent down and kissed him on his forehead.
Try not to wake me, if you come to sleep tonight.
Chapter 5. The next day, the students drifted in slowly as usual. Some took their seats. Others stood around talking. Robert Billings was by the windows, tying knots in the blind cords. While he was doing that, Brad, his incessant tormentor, walked past and patted him on the back, sticking a small sign that said, "Kick me," to his shirt. It looked like just another typical day in history class until the kids noticed that their teacher had written in large letters across the blackboard, "Strength through discipline."
"What's that supposed to mean?" someone asked.
"I'll tell you just as soon as you're all seated," Ben Ross answered. When the kids were all in their places, he began to lecture. "Today I am going to talk to you about discipline." A collective groan went up from the seated students. There were some teachers whose classes you knew would be a drag, but most of the students expected Ross's history class to be pretty good, which meant no dumb lectures on stuff like discipline.
"Hold it," Ben told them. "Before you make a judgment, give this a chance. It could be exciting."
"Oh, sure," someone said.
"Oh, sure is right," Ben told his students.
"Now when I talk about discipline, I'm talking about power," he said, making a fist to accentuate the point. "And I'm talking about success. Success through discipline. Is there anyone here who isn't interested in power and success?"
"Probably Robert," Brad said.
A bunch of kids snickered.
"Now wait," Ben told them. "David, Brian, Eric, you play football. You already know it takes discipline to win."
"That must be why we haven't won a game in 2 years," Eric said, and the class laughed.
It took their teacher a few moments to calm them down again.
"Listen," he said, gesturing toward a pretty red-haired student who appeared to be sitting taller in her chair than those around her. "Andrea, you're a ballet dancer. Doesn't it take ballet dancers long, hard hours of work to develop their skills?"
She nodded, and Ross turned to the rest of the class.
"It's the same with every art. Painting, writing, music, all of them take years of hard work and discipline to master. Hard work, discipline, and control."
"So what?" said a student who was slouching down in his chair.
"So what?" Ben asked. "I'll show you. Suppose I could prove to you that you can create power through discipline. Suppose we could do it right here in this classroom. What would you say to that?"
Ross had expected another wisecrack, and he was surprised when it didn't come. Instead, the students were becoming interested and curious. Ben went behind his desk and pulled his wooden chair in front of the room so that all the students could see it.
"All right," he said. "Discipline begins with posture. Amy, come up here for a minute."
As Amy rose, Brian mumbled, "Teacher's pet." Normally, that would have been enough to start the entire class laughing, but only a few chuckled. The rest ignored him. Everyone was wondering what their teacher was up to. As Amy sat in the chair at the front of the room, Ben instructed her on how to sit.
"Place your hands flat across the small of your back and force your spine straight up. There. Can't you breathe more easily?"
Around the classroom, many of the students were imitating the position they saw Amy taking. But even though they were sitting straighter, some couldn't help finding it humorous. David was the next to try his hand at a joke.
"Is this history, or did I come to phys ed by mistake?" he asked.
A few kids laughed, but still tried to improve their posture.
"Come on, David," Ben said. "Give it a try. We've had enough wise guy remarks."
Grudgingly, David pushed himself up straight in his chair. Meanwhile, their teacher walked down each aisle, checking the posture of each student. It was amazing, Ross thought. Somehow he'd hooked them. Why, even Robert. "Class," Ben announced. "I want everyone to see how Robert's legs are parallel. His ankles are locked, his knees are bent at 90 degrees. See how straight his spine is? Chin tucked in, head up. That's very good, Robert." Robert, the class nerd, looked up at his teacher and smiled briefly, then returned to his stiff, upright position. Around the room, the other students tried to copy him. Ben returned to the front of the classroom. "All right. Now I want you all to get up and walk around the room. When I give the command, I want you to return to your seats as quickly as possible and assume the proper seating posture. Come on, everyone. Up, up, up." The students stood up and started wandering around the room. Ben knew he couldn't let them go too long or they'd lose their concentration on the exercise, so he quickly said, "Take your seats." The students dashed back to their seats. There were bumps and grunts as a few ran into each other, and around the room some kids laughed, but the dominant sound was the loud scraping of chair legs as the kids sat down. In front of the room, Ben shook his head. "That was the most disorganized mess I've ever seen. This isn't Duck Duck Goose. This is an experiment in movement and posture. Now come on, let's try it again. This time without the chatter. The quicker and more controlled you are, the faster you will be able to reach your seats properly. Okay? Now everyone, up." For the next 20 minutes, the class practiced getting out of their seats, wandering around in apparent disorganization, and then, at their teacher's command, quickly returning to their seats and the correct seated posture. Ben shouted orders more like a drill sergeant than a teacher. Once they seemed to have mastered quick and correct seating, he threw in a new twist. They would still leave their seats and return, but now they would return from the hallway, and Ross would time them with a stopwatch. On the first try, it took 48 seconds. The second time, they were able to do it in half a minute. Before the last attempt, David had an idea. "Listen," he told his classmates as they stood outside in the hall waiting for Mr. Ross's signal. "Let's line up in the order of who has to go the farthest to reach their desks inside. That way we won't have to bump into each other." The rest of the class agreed. As they got into the correct order, they couldn't help noticing that Robert was at the head of the line. "The new head of the class," someone whispered as they waited nervously for their teacher to give them the sign. Ben snapped his fingers and the column of students moved quickly and quietly into the room. As the last student reached his seat, Ben clicked the stopwatch off. He was smiling. 16 seconds! The class cheered. All right, quiet down," their teacher said, returning to the front of the room. To his surprise, the students calmed down quickly. The silence that suddenly filled the room was almost eerie. Normally, the only time the room was that still, Ross thought, was when it was empty. "Now, there are three more rules that you must obey," he told them. "One, everybody must have pencils and notepaper for note-taking. 2. When asking or answering a question, you must stand at the side of your seats. And 3. The first words you say when answering or asking a question are, Mr. Ross. All right?" Around the room, heads nodded. "All right," Mr. Ross said. "Brad, who was the British Prime Minister before Churchill?" Still sitting at his seat, Brad chewed nervously on a fingernail. "Wasn't it..." But before he could say more, Mr. Ross quickly cut him off. "Wrong, Brad. You already forgot the rules I just told you." He looked across the room at Robert. "Robert, show Brad the proper procedure for answering a question." Instantly, Robert stood up next to his desk at attention. "Mr. Ross." "Correct," Mr. Ross said.
Thank you, Robert.
Ah, this is dumb, Brad mumbled. Just because you couldn't do it right, someone said.
Brad, Mr. Ross said, who was the Prime Minister before Churchill? This time Brad rose and stood beside his desk.
Mr. Ross, it was, Prime Minister,
You're still too slow, Brad, Mr. Ross said.